Tonight on Arena, we celebrate the life and work of poet, playwright and translator Derek Mahon. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Sad news came through today of the death of the poet Derek Mahon. He was 78, author of so many collections of groundbreaking work, Lives, The Snow Party, The Hudson Letter, Harbour Lights and Life on Earth. He was also a playwright and translator. We have a wonderful gathering of friends and admirers to pay a tribute to Derek Mahon on this Friday evening. But let's begin with a poem that in fact will feature in Mahon's next collection called Washing Up, which is due for publication later this month. He wrote this poem during lockdown, and it's the poem himself, Derek Mahon, who reads it for us. A Fox on Grafton Street.
Broad daylight and on weed-grown cobblestones, deserted by the pedestrian population, a fox hunts for discarded edibles. Fried chips, spare ribs or chicken bones. But everywhere from Bewley's to McDonald's is shut and shuttered for the duration. Sam's a celebrity fox, an online hero, briefly promoted to the infosphere. His bold image shared by a world of folks anxious like him for sustenance. Can a fox not do its solitary, unorthodox research without some human interference? Desperate now, he quarters an empty strip, sniffing at every drain and rubbish tip. This should be a great time for foxes, but there are no scraps, no pizza boxes, stuffing the bins so they overflow. The young aren't going there right now. He'd be far better off where he belongs, out in the country with his hens and ducks, rabbits, field mice and other tasty things. No doubt he's puzzled since the very vox pop barely whispers and the electric songs are silent. But in a shameful paradox, there reigns a shocked euphoria during this short respite, this enforced parenthesis. We're back in the days before we declared war on the last outposts of resilient nature. Even perhaps in some oblique future, only dreamers ever dreamt before.
The poet Derek Mahon there reading his poem, A Fox on Grafton Street. And as I said, that will be in his upcoming collection, Washing Up, due for publication later this month. And that recording released online only this week. And obviously that is the last recording that Derek Mahon will have made, because as I say, sadly, his death announced earlier today, 78. And over the period on the programme, we'll be speaking with Michael Longley, Paula Meehan, Gerald Daw, the poets. Critic and author of the poetry of Derek Mahon, Hugh Houghton, will be here with us as well, as will biographer Matthew Geaton, and Paul Muldoon will join us a little later on as well. I'll come to you first, if I could, Michael Longley, because I know, yes, you've lost a fellow poet, but you've also lost a friend on Thursday evening. A difficult time, I would have thought.
Well, of course it is. Derek and I were friends. Well, I still think of us, we are friends, for more than 60 years. Can you imagine? We go right the way back to about 1958. And we went to the same school, but we didn't know each other there. Our friendship didn't really get underway until Trinity College, Dublin. And it was there that we served our poetic apprenticeships side by side, sharing poems, arguing. We used to have morning seminars in O'Neill's Pub in Suffolk Street, I remember. And I remember in those days, I was dazzled by Derek's precocity and brilliance. I mean, he had already been writing very brilliant poems for the school magazine. And then he came to Trinity already practiced and gifted. And in a way, I'm still dazzled by his gifts. I mean, from the very beginning, Derek was a master of the singing line and the resonant stanza. Mm. I mean, he had what musicians call perfect pitch. I don't think Derek could have written a bad line if he tried to. There's always a very elegant musical lift to his words. I said some time ago that Derek Mahan wrote great poems, and that makes him a great poet. And he wrote immortal poems, and that makes him an immortal poet. I mean, from the very beginning, his undergraduate poetry, the voice of authority rings out. I would also like to celebrate the fact that we had so much fun together.
Well, clearly morning seminars in the pub suggests a lot of fun was had during the time in Trinity.
Yeah, that's right. And we shared a very untidy Becketty and flat in Merrion Square for a time in the early 60s. My wife-to-be, Edna, would come in and clean the milk bottles. And I don't know how we survived there. And we've kept in touch over the years. And I'd also like to say that Derek could be wickedly hilarious company. I'm sorry, I have a cough.
I'll come back to you, Michael. Why don't you get a drink of water there for yourself, and I'll come back to you in a second, because you touched there on this idea of, obviously you knew each other in Belfast, but you met in Trinity, and I'll go back to the Belfast days, if I could, just to get a picture of that with Hugh Houghton, the author of the Poetry of Derek Mahan. You both knew Derek Mahan, Hugh, and you wrote extensively on his poetry. Let's start at that working class upbringing in Belfast. And Michael Longley mentioning to us there that even the very early poetry was noteworthy. Was that the theme of those early poems to a large extent, that family background?
It was and it wasn't. There's a strong sense of being rooted in Belfast, but maybe reluctantly rooted. He talks about one part of my mind must learn to know its place, the things that happen in the kitchen houses and echoing back streets of this desperate city. But the desperate city suggests a note of a kind of impatience. I mean, it was a work. His dad worked in Harland and Wolff, and his mum at the York Street Flax Spinning Company. And it was a kind of a strong working class background, but I think it was a place that he was always, in a sense, trying to escape from. And his poetry is a kind of extraordinary voyaging and comparing and setting one place against another. I mean, that was the primal place, I think, Belfast, but it's evoked often very negatively in poems like Ecclesiastes and so on.
Yeah.
And there's a wonderful poem, I think, written after Trinity, when he'd moved to London, and it's called Afterlives. And in it he asks, "But the hills are still the same, grey blue above Belfast. Perhaps if I'd stayed behind and lived it bomb by bomb, I might have grown up at last and learnt what is meant by home."
That
rhyme of home and bomb is itself a kind of bombshell.
Yeah, astonishing stuff. Let me ask Gerald Daw a little bit about that Belfast period, in fact, as well, Gerald, because you've chosen to talk about his collection Lives, and that really relates back to that early part of his life, doesn't it? Harland and Wolff, the big cranes, Samson and Delilah, the shadow of those two cranes, huge on his life and in his poems.
Yes, I think so. I mean, Hugh just mentioned Ecclesiastes, but there's also a kind of sense in which Derek had the inside track on Belfast. He both loved and detached himself from it. I mean, there are poems later on where he revisits Belfast, but maybe loving might be stretching it a bit, but he certainly kind of revisits the place with a different kind of eye. And in the documentary he did, The Poetry Nonsense, I mean, he very delicately stepped his way around North Belfast and its streets and its avenues. And there was a kind of hesitant sense of almost awe as he walked around the streets of his childhood. I always felt, certainly in Lives, which was the, it's almost like an album. I remember buying it in 1972 in Belfast and getting this sort of shock when I saw on the cover of it the Titanic in its housing and the workers leaving. I mean, there was a sense in which this was not spoken about. This was not written about. That industrial past had been kind of foreclosed in terms of writing. Whereas this incredibly sophisticated, cosmopolitan, dainty kind of writer, if you like, he was revisiting it in his poems. And it was really it was very, very exciting for a young lad. I was in my late teens, maybe I was heading towards being 20, when I picked it up in Mullins Bookshop in Belfast. And I still remember it. So he had that kind of local presence, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and actually Paul Muldoon is on the line now as well, Gerald. And I think, Paul, you would refer to that local presence, to use Gerald's phrase, the shadow of Belfast, and that Ulster Protestant tradition very strong in his work.
Well, you know, there were a number of writers who, of course, fed into Derek Mahon. And no one springs fully formed from anyone's brow. There were a couple of writers, Louis MacNeice, of course, preeminently, and W.R. Rogers to some extent, who were there in the background and who I think really are important to remember in this context. But Derek was doing something quite remarkable from the outset. And I remember vividly, there's mention there of Mullins Bookstore. I was a schoolboy in Armagh. And Tom McGurk, who was a fellow student and well known to RTE listeners, made a single trip, a trip with one purpose, to Belfast, to Mullins Bookstore, to buy Night Crossing. And he brought it back to the school, and we all sort of gathered round as if we were gathering round some great piece of treasure that had been unearthed, maybe from one of his later poems. Mm. And a treasure it was. I mean, those first poems were quite remarkable. I think he may have come to disown some of them along the way. Who knows? He had a habit sometimes of disowning things he shouldn't really have disowned at all.
Let me ask about, because I have a very interesting clip here about, I don't know whether this is disowning or not that we're talking about. It's Derek himself speaking with Yvan Boland, and he's talking about the Belfast that he grew up on and the Belfast of the 1970s. And is this disowning or not? Let's have a listen.
What I think set me writing more than anything else was a desire, which no doubt I shared with everyone, everyone at that age, to somehow create an alternative to the situation in which I found myself. And I'm talking about the general misery and wretchedness and ugliness of the city of Belfast, which no one is going to deny. And a feeling that grew upon me when I was 16 or 17, that surely there is more to life than this. Surely there must be something somewhere beautiful and desirable and admirable, not this squalor. And so I set about creating, in classic adolescent fashion, an alternative world, if you like. And the way I chose to do this was by writing poetry.
You speak there of the wretchedness, the lack of inspiration anyway, in the environment of Belfast. You've said already that you were pretty, you know, isolated from the religious tension, so it wasn't this that contributed to the wretchedness. What was it that you know, invested that environment of North Belfast with, you know, sufficiently indistinct inspiration to make you want to create another world?
Well, not North Belfast only. And while I wasn't in the forefront of my mind conscious of religious tensions, they are part of the circumstances. They're one of the circumstances which create this wretchedness, this constant sense of bad temper and frustration and impotence. that I was trying to get away from. The way the streets seemed to end at a full stop, nothing seemed to lead anywhere. The introspection of everyone, the sort of communal introspection, the fact that someone like an uncle of mine, for example, who had been to sea for many years, was to me an immensely romantic figure because he had actually been out of Belfast, if you like. You know, it was incredible to me that this man had spent so long out of the city.
There you go, Derek Mahon. Speaking to Yvonne Boland, in fact, in that interview from 1970. And I suppose, Michael Longley, that really must bring back memories because it's a little bit later than the Trinity time, is it? Or was that kind of at the centre of it all, 1970?
A bit later. I think that was the young, very young Mahon. I could hardly recognise his voice.
Yeah.
And he was in revolt at that time. I think he got to like this place a little bit more. It was much bleaker than anything I can remember in his response to his native city, which we all know what Belfast is like, warts and all. But after all, in his poetry, Derek made the back streets and the shipyards of Belfast as much a part of the Irish landscape as Connemara or Kerry. And he's a celebrant of the city as well as an astute critic.
Yeah, well, listen, I will say goodbye to you at this point, Michael, and thank you so much for speaking with us this evening on this very sad occasion. And I'll come to you again, Gerald Daw. Michael mentioned there this idea of, you know, how he brought the streets, the urban life of Belfast, to the attention of a wider readership. You make comparisons with what Seamus Heaney did for the rural, perhaps Derek Mahon did for the urban.
Well, I think, I mean, that's one way of reading it. I mean, Derek's sense of the city, I mean, it started out of Belfast, but I mean, it went on to Dublin, obviously, but when he went to Trinity, and then London, where he lived, New York, of course, which he lived in, and Paris, and I mean, points in between. I mean, Derek's sense of the world was very open. It was a bit like that uncle he refers to. I mean, he did have a kind of almost maritime swagger to him at times when he was in a city. He loved being on streets. He liked street life. He liked being around the kind of the scents and smells of city. Even it's kind of as the poem you just opened the show with. I mean, the fox, you know, moving around in the kind of detritus of the city. So, I mean, I think city life was just, he was just hardwired to that. But the other side of that, Sean, is that there was a very intriguing, he had a very physical sense of landscape and nature as well. His poems are full of bird life. They're full of the coastal areas that he inhabited. There is a kind of almost a Yeatsian sort of sense of rivers as much as the big story of the oceans. He was a very, very tuned in to how small little creaturely life contains this kind of the vitalities of life itself.
And Paul Muldoon, then, to come to you again, Paul, what poetical eye are we experiencing in a poem that you wanted to read for us, Courtyard in Delft?
Well, you know, I was struck there listening to his conversation with dear Yvonne Boland when he describes the dead end, as it were, the hill at the end of the street. And I agree with Michael Longley that's a younger version of himself, I think, because he's also the great, he glories, he takes such delight in the hill at the end of the street, almost as if it were opening up a new vista. So it's as if he's torn between these two ideas of being shut in and yet with a sense of what's beyond. One of his great Belfast poems, of course, is Courtyards in Delft, which describes a painting by Peter de Hoogh, and it's dated 1659. And of course, not long after that, in 1690, for example, the Dutch king made his presence felt in Ireland, and Derek so slyly, beautifully, you know, without overstating anything. He was a master of the understated, or almost the non-stated. You know, that is lurking around in the background of this poem. Mm. When he was talking about the squalor, when I was a kid, I was brought up as a Catholic, of course, and I hope this is not going to offend anyone, but one of our terms for a really spick and span household was that it was very Protestant-looking. And I think that's what he's describing here in this poem. Oblique light on the trite, on brick and tile, immaculate masonry. And everywhere that water tap, that broom and wooden pail to keep it so. House proud, the wives of artisans pursue their thrifty lives among scrubbed yards, modest but adequate. Foliage is sparse and clings. No breeze ruffles the trim composure of those trees. I'll just skip on a little bit. That girl with her back to us who waits for her man to come home for his tea. You almost want to say tay. Will wait till the paint disintegrates and ruined dikes admit the Assyrian sea. Great Mahon touch. Rather than saying hungry, we have the Assyrian. He was an educational system himself. Yet this is life too. And the cracked outhouse door, a verifiable fact, as vividly mnemonic as the sunlight railings, the sunlit railings that front the houses opposite. I lived there as a boy and know the coal glittering in its shed, late afternoon lambency informing the deal table, the ceiling cradled in a radiant spoon. I must be lying low in a room there, a strange child with a taste for verse, while my hard-nosed companions dream of fire and sword upon parched veldt and fields of rain-swept gorse. So there's another stanza of that poem, which is one's never quite sure if it's in or out. He had a habit, as I suggested earlier on, of revision, which was quite, I mean, he was very hard on himself.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, one of the interesting things I think that you bring up in the midst of that, Paul Muldoon, I want to bring in Paula Meehan at this point. Paul mentioning there, making a little aside to us, Paula, about he was an education system almost in and of himself. You experienced Derek Mahon, Paula Meehan, you experienced him as, was it a series of workshops? He was a writer in residence when you were a student yourself in Trinity. Was this in the 80s?
Well, this, I had already left Trinity and travelled and I was writing, and I came back to Dublin myself after some rambles, and I saw an ad, Derek Mahon, writer in residence, will conduct a workshop in the community, which meant we sat in this big cavernous old sweatshop down in Temple Bar at a rickety table, six of us and Derek holding court. And he interviewed me before the workshop, I think to check me out, because he said he didn't want me bringing any of that feminist stuff into his work. So he had my measure for sure. And at the workshop, I met Mary O'Donnell and Sarah Berkeley, two distinguished poets now in their own right. But we were very devoted to Derek, absolutely, to the work. I mean, he doesn't just have readers. He really has devotees. And it was a strange time, the 1984. The recession was really deep and Dublin was quite dark. It was all butter vouchers and Rowley cigarettes. But he was fantastic. I mean, he was taking us seriously. And what else does a young poet want from someone who is absolute craftsman, to take you seriously? And he took us seriously. And it was very melancholy, that workshop. We often sat in silence for minutes at a time after a poem broke that silence. And it was a very moving experience. And I think I learned that craft, actually learning your craft, could be the best defense and the best protection in a poetry that was wrought out of his woundedness. Well, he was very generous with his time and his consideration. And he more or less said, listen, I can't teach you to write poetry. It's a long and lonely and sometimes demented road. You have to teach yourself. But there are great writers living and dead. And that is the communion of poets that you live amongst.
Well, Paula, listen, I know we were due to speak about your selected poems this evening, so thank you very much for joining us.
We're so grateful that at the harvest moon, he has left us this amazing harvest for when the green wears off.
And we'll talk to you about your selected poems hopefully next week at some point along the way. We'll catch up on that particular side of things. I'll also say thanks to Paul Muldoon and to Gerald Daw at this point as well. I want to go to Matthew Geaton. In fact, Matthew, you have written the biography of Derek Mahon. And you know him from his Kinsale time. So you might explain, you know, we've had the fact that he came from Belfast to Trinity. He went to France. He went to the Sorbonne to study for a period of time. There was time in America as well. When did Kinsale become a part of his life, Matthew?
Yeah, so Kinsale was a part of Derek's life for quite a long time, actually, longer than people realise. He first came down here in his Trinity days, actually, in the 1960s. And he was delivering an Afghan hound to Hedley McNeice, Leary McNeice's wife, who was living down in Kinsale and had opened a little restaurant called the Spinnaker, which actually turned out to be one of the kind of forerunners for the Good Food Circle, which put Kinsale on the map. But in those days, Kinsale was a fishing town. It was quite poor. But there was something about the town that Derek always liked and remembered. Mm. And then later in his life, in 1986, his marriage, unfortunately, had broken down at the time. And to get some space for himself, he came and lived in Kinsale in the poet Desmond O'Grady's house on the outskirts of Kinsale there for the summer. Desmond was away teaching in Rome, I think. And so Derek
Could I ask, Matthew, to what extent, because there were difficulties in his life, you know, earlier on, particularly I think alcohol may have been a problem at some stage along the way. Did Kinsale help to get rid of those demons, if you like? Because there was a late flourishing, if you think of Harbour Lights from 2005, Life on Earth 2008, Absolutely. Against the Clock 2018, and the one that we're going to get in the coming month, Washing Up. Did Kinsale help to banish that aspect of his life, or at least to put it to rest?
Yeah, I think it did. But unfortunately, there were two phases. So the first time he moved here in 86 was very much, you know, he was getting over the breakdown in the marriage. And so Kinsale in those times was quite a wild place, lots of late night drinking, drunken misdemeanors. And that, after a while, took its toll on Derek and he had to leave. But he came back, as you say, in 2003. And that was such a wonderful positive time for him, I think. You know, it was a different Kinsale. Those days had gone, and Kinsale was developing into, you know, more like a kind of cafe culture, which really suited Derek.
Yeah.
You know, it reminded him, I think, actually, of his early days in Belfast as a sort of teenager. He used to meet his friends in cafes in Belfast and talk about poetry and writing. And, you know, he used to love, you know, coming into Kinsale town and meeting and chatting about the,
and I'm sure there's great sadness in Kinsale tonight, particularly because of that. And thanks for sharing your thoughts with us this evening, Matthew Geaton. And to bring us full circle then to Hugh Houghton, author of The Poetry of Derek Mahon, I leave you with that final question that we try to do in these situations, is to somehow sum up what the legacy of Derek Mahon is. What would you say to that, Hugh?
It's a hard one. The legacy seems to be singularly plural, as Louis McNeice said. One of the extraordinary things is that he was both an all-Ireland poet. I mean, Belfast, Dublin and Cork all figure hugely. But also he was had a kind of global reach and travel. And that involved not only all the places he wrote about, London, Paris, Rome, New York, Moscow, Florida, and many, many others, Japan, but also his engagement, I think, with global culture. He is one of the most important ecological poets we have now, about survival of nature and the threats to nature posed by culture. But he's so wonderful at that because he is a poet always situating whatever he's looking at locally. It could be a potato, as in the new book, or a seashell. And he poses it, situates it in a global context. And it's that combination of kind of reaching into a place, a specific place or an object, and reaching out to a vision of the world as a whole that makes him a uniquely cosmopolitan and local intelligence, with an extraordinary legacy of poems that we will be feeding off for years to come.
Right, thank you so much for those thoughts. That's Hugh Houghton, author of The Poetry of Derek Mahon. And we'll finish with Derek Mahon himself and a poem that was actually, this recording that we're about to hear was made in 2011 to mark the publication of Derek Mahon's new collected poems by Gallery Press. But in recent times, many people have taken great found solace in this poem and the period we're going through at the moment. Derek Mahon with his poem, Everything is Going to Be All Right.
Everything is going to be all right. Why should I not be glad to contemplate the clouds clearing beyond the dormer window and a high tide reflected on the ceiling? There will be dying, but there is no need to go into that. The poems flow from the hand unbidden, and the hidden source is the watchful heart. The sun rises in spite of everything, and the far cities are beautiful and bright. I lie here in a riot of sunlight, watching the day break and the clouds fly. Everything is going to be all right.
Derek Mahon and his poem, Everything is Going to Be All Right. My thanks to Gerald Daw, Paul Muldoon, Paula Meehan, Michael Longley, Matthew Geaton and Hugh Houghton for their offerings to us this evening, and that celebration of the life and work of Derek Mahon, whose death was announced today. He died on Thursday evening. He was 78. And so to the final section of Friday evening's programme and album reviews as usual. First up, dance floor diva and fashion icon Roisin Murphy is back with the magnificently titled fifth solo album, Roisin Machine. Working Men's Club created quite a stir after a bidding war amongst record labels when they emerged from their Manchester base early last year. Their debut album is out today. It's called Working Men's Club, as is the band. Finally, to keep you in a dancing mood, kind of, I think, for the weekend, Groove Armada, back with the first album in 10 years. It's called Edge of the Horizon. Kellyanne Byrne, Eamon Sweeney have been listening. And let's start with Roisin Murphy. Roisin Machine is the album. And here's a track called Narcissus.
Love is here, all your protection.
Oh yes, Róisín Murphy there, and Narcissus, the title of the track from her new album, Róisín Machine. As I said, Kellyanne Byrne and Eamon Sweeney are two reviewers this evening, and we were dancing along in studio, yeah. Kellyanne, to that for sure.
A lot
of chair dancing going on. It strikes me about Róisín Murphy, at one level you listen to it musically and you think, oh, this is, yeah, these are all, you know, get out on the floor stuff.
Yeah.
But there's always something else going on with Róisín Murphy.
Absolutely. I think, you know, that's actually one of the greatest things about this record is when you listen, you're like, oh, yeah, so much of this would fit in a club. And she said it's an homage to her clubbing days. But that said, there's a melancholy there. There's a melancholy there on records like Something More, which is about the idea that no matter what we have in life, we're never satisfied. And, you know, so it's like I've 10 men in my bed, I'm eating in the finest restaurants and I still want something more. There's a melancholy to simulation and even to the tracks about relationships, incapable and jealousy. So I feel like it's a very autobiographical record.
Yeah. And that she manages to do this thing of talking about her life, but it never sounds confessional, Eamon Sweeney. I think it's safe to say you don't get all that, you know, you're not that there's a being confessional is necessarily bad, but you know, it's not self-indulgent in any way or shape or form. That really struck me. And this is a woman who has outlived, you know, the dance duo Moloko in the 1990s, which was all about dance. She just brings it to a new place and she's done it again in this album.
Oh, absolutely. I would totally agree. And is Overpowered was a very, very strong record. But that's going back to 2007. Mm. And then around 2015, then she did kind of like two albums in the middle of the space of the year, Hairless Toys and Take Her Up to Monto. So it's been, you know, a relatively short wait of 4 years. But in terms of the production and the sound, and think that the first two tracks, I think, are absolutely stunning, and the way that they segue into each other completely seamlessly. I think a lot of credit there due to a guy called Richard Barrett. Yeah. Not Richard Boyd Barrett, by the way. DJ Parrish is kind of a pseudonym. Think of Richard Boyd Barrett with an eye patch and maybe a parrot on his shoulder. He's been pals with Róisín way back since the Moloko days. And it's a collaboration that they've kind of reignited here. And it works magnificently.
And in fact, those opening three tracks, Simulation, Kingdom of Ends and Something More, they're all songs. Is Simulation maybe 8 minutes long, I think?
Simulation is 8 minutes, 30 seconds.
Kingdom of Ends is 6 minutes. Something More is 7 minutes. That's like a big set.
Yeah.
You'd be tired after dancing to the three of those.
But it shows what balls she has as an artist to open.
To do that as an
to
opener.
To do that. Yeah. In particular, Simulation as an opener. Mm. 8 minutes, 30 seconds, minimal record. She's got so much guts.
Well, she also has guts to, I think, some of the titles here. I know you weren't particularly fond of Shellfish Mademoiselle. I thought it was a witty title, Eamon. But let us go to the one that I think we'll all agree on is probably the best title on the, apart from the album title itself, Róisín Machine. A track called Murphy's Law. My favourite title, Murphy's Law from Róisín Murphy and Róisín Machine. We are just loving it here in studio, Eamon. What is your overall judgment on this album? Is it going to solidify your position? I think it is, as a star. And how many stars from you, Eamon Sweeney, first?
Oh, I would go 3.5. I do think it's an excellent album. I don't think it quite hits the peak of Overpowered, or I'm a big fan of Take Her Up to Monto, which is the weird experimental one, which probably speaks more about me rather than Róisín Murphy. But 3.5.
A solid 3.5 then for me. I think yours is more than solid.
Yeah,
Kellyanne Byrne.
I think it's her finest record to date, and I gave it 5 out of 5.
Kellyanne Byrne. There you go, Róisín Murphy and Róisín Machine. I suppose it was Murphy's Law. We were going to get a 5 out of 5 tonight. I'm here all week. 3.5 from
Eamon, let's tell you what, we're going to talk about two other albums, Working Men's Club and Groove Armada, in a couple of minutes' time. And so, Roisin Murphy's Roisin Machine getting 3.5 out of 5 from Eamon Sweeney, 5 out of 5 from Kellyanne Byrne. Kellyanne said to me during the ad break, Eamon, that she might talk to you during the next two reviews because you only gave it 3.5. So hopefully I can settle matters between the two of you. Working Men's Club is the name of a quartet from the north of England. Yeah. Made something of a splash when they arrived on the British music scene in 2019. Ones to watch, that famous phrase was used for, about them in the Guardian list for 2019. And their self-titled debut album is released today. 18-year-old Sydney Minsky Sargent is at the heart of
what
all
a name.
Of this.
Yeah. What a name. Yeah.
Tell us about him, and he's talking about Yorkshire and growing up in Yorkshire. That's basically what we're talking about here, Kellyanne.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, so he's, as you say, he's just 18 years old, and much of the record is really about growing up in Todmorden, I believe is the name of the town. Mm-hmm. Small town in Yorkshire with very little going on, and I guess as a teenager he felt quite suffocated, and so that's running through the entire album. But I'm just really astounded at his musical ability and his ability as a songwriter at just 18 years old. It's really phenomenal.
Are you more in accord on this album? I think you may well be, Eamon.
Yeah, I really like it. For a guy so young, as Kellyanne was just saying, the dizzying range of influences. I hear bits of Soft Cell, The Fall, A Guy Called Gerald, A Certain Ratio, The Human League, 808 State, and just a kind of with their own twist on it. Like, you know, for somebody that young to have that breadth of musical knowledge. And they're kind of joined, they're teenagers. A girl called Mairead O'Connor, who definitely sounds like she's got Irish roots, from the band called The Moon Landings, this kind of crazy psychedelic band. She has joined the band, and this seems to have given them, oh, I suppose a bit more street cred in a way. And there's been, you know, there's an A&R signing war over them at the Great Escape at Brighton there last year, which is kind of the main kind of hotbed for emerging young talent in the UK. They were the complete talk of the town. Yeah. Their live show that obviously we're not going to see anytime soon apparently is amazing. The Sydney Minsky Sargent gives it socks and apparently takes his top off a lot and gets up close and personal with members of the crowd. Obviously very not quite social distancing friendly, so I don't think we're going to see them maybe in a live venue anytime soon, but a really good record.
All right.
Oh, well, unbelievable.
Let's listen to the opening record, which is called Valleys. Why is the darkness so strong? I'm feeling broken again. So many points to divide. Each in its right does not sense. Oh, I was so glad. I was just about to speak when that wonderful synthy vibe came in there, and that's
unbelievable.
Yeah, a track called Valleys, the opening track. In fact, it opens a lot slower than that. It kind of builds before it gets to that full on dance version that we're getting there. Is it more than a dance album, or is it essentially just a dance, Eamon Sweeney?
I don't really see it as purely a kind of a club album. Like the last track goes on for about 12 minutes. It's very much a wig out. It's obviously the thing they probably closed their live show on, and it's kind of becomes a bit of a jam. A bit unnecessary, probably the weakest point in the album, and you really want an album to kind of finish on a high when it's that good. Be My Guest, I thought was a very interesting track, and any band that calls a song John Cooper Clarke is pretty good in my book. You know?
That's one of the best songs on it, actually. Yeah,
do they use his? Are they his words? Or do we know? Are they John Cooper Clarke's words? It's kind of a spoken word track, really, isn't it? That
I
track?
Don't know. Is it, Eamon? I'm not sure.
To the best of my knowledge, now just kind of reading about it, it's just a homage. They're in good company. Arctic Monkeys, famously, kind of like that's well documented. Yeah. And I'm reading the John Cooper Clarke autobiography at the moment. It's wonderful.
There you go. So, and you're playing the track in the background all the time, clearly,
absolutely,
when you're doing that. By the way, Michelle Cahill, a listener, has been in touch. I presume Michelle is from Todmorden.
I pronounced it wrong.
Yeah, I think that's now, I'm looking at it on the screen in front of me. Todmorden.
Oh,
or Todmorden. Oh, it's gone. Michelle Cahill. So Michelle is batting for the Todmorden pronunciation team. Stars from you on this album, Kelly Ann Byrne.
I absolutely love this record. I found it so inspiring. One of the best of the year. I gave it 4.5.
4.5? Yeah. And what are you saying here, Eamon?
I would go 4. And incidentally, a weird bit of trivia about Todd Morton. Apparently, he's got the highest number of UFO sightings in the UK.
I thought you were going to say the highest number of suicides. Judging by the lyrics.
Well, it's a bit dark, but I thought you were going to say the highest number of mispronunciations of the title. So, what did we get there? How many stars did we get?
Four and a half.
And what did you say, Eamon?
Four.
From you. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Let us move on then, because Kellyanne has her glittery jacket on, which was clearly for those first two dance albums. I don't know if Groove Armada... we haven't heard from Groove Armada for 10 years, Kellyanne?
Well, 10 years they haven't performed as a live band.
All right.
So their last studio album was back in 2010. It was called Black Light. And they took about a break from touring as a live band because they said that back at, during that period they were fed up with the EDM scene at the time and being shoved into that bracket when they really didn't fit. So they kind of went underground. They were still DJing and doing other things but not performing as a live band. And so this is their first studio album in 10 years. It's their eighth studio album.
All right. And the opening track, which made me think, oh, yeah, we're in for another big dance number here. It's called Get Out on the Dance Floor. Yeah. But don't be running out, because when you get there, you'll have to slow down. Okay, I'll have to come out of Get Out on the Dance Floor. Yeah, I certainly found that a little bit downbeat. Maybe that's in comparison to the other two albums, Eamon Sweeney. But it features Nick Littlemore, who is one of many collaborators on this album, actually.
Yeah, totally, from Empire of the Sun, who've been very successful in their own right. I don't like his vocal at all that we just heard. I think it just sounds like he's trying to channel James Murphy of LCD Sound System. And to me, it's a weak pastiche. And it doesn't.
Didn't do it for you. And other collaborators that are on there as well, James Alexander Bright, and Todd Edwards is in there as well, isn't he,
Kellyanne? Yeah, Todd Edwards. So Todd Edwards is an American garage and house DJ who probably is most well known for his work with Daft Punk. And he's on a track called Lover For Now that samples a classic disco tune from 1985 called Faces by Cleo. It's one of the highlights on the album. I think that record, actually, Lover For Now, featuring Todd Edwards. I love that track.
You're in disagreement once again on this one, it has to be said. Triumphant Return.
I had a feeling that would happen.
Yeah, Triumphant Return is what you're saying, Kellyanne?
I loved it, yeah, because they stated that a lot of the record was influenced by what they were listening to whilst they were on tour, which was a lot of yacht rock and soul. So Michael McDonald, Doobie Brothers, Steely Dan, that kind of thing. And you hear that throughout the record. So if you're looking for big dance numbers like I See You Baby and all the rest of it, that's not there.
And that means how many stars for you?
I gave it 4.
Four, so you were happy on this one.
Yeah.
Not a Triumphant Return. What was it for you, Eamon?
I think it'd be generous to give it a 1. I think it's really, rancid. Like Bad Sting, Seal, Prince. The yacht thing, like that rock's fine if you're Fleetwood Mac, but it's more REO Speedwagon.
Okay. I'll give the last line of your notes so that you, because you won't say disappointing and rather pointless comeback was what Eamon had to say. So a difference of opinion for sure on Groove Armada and Roisin Murphy, Roisin Machine and Edge of the Horizon, and Accord on Working Men's Club and their self-titled debut album. That is our lot on this Friday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Cullen was on sound this evening. And I'd also like to express our thanks to Rob Canning and the team in archives, particularly for the material they found for us for our tribute to Derek Mahon earlier on in the programme this evening. But that's our lot for tonight. Tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you Monday, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1.